This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today, the story of King Records. Come on, baby. That's Hank Ballard with the original recording of The Twist, a song later made famous by Chubby Checker. Ballard's version was on King Records, an influential independent label that was founded by Sid Nathan, who ran it from 1943 until 1971. King also recorded the original versions of Fever and Good Rockin' Tonight. Not the most famous label, but this Cincinnati-based label was very influential. It launched the careers of James Brown, Hank Ballard, Cowboy Copas, and Freddie King. In a time of racial segregation, it recorded country, blues, and rhythm and blues performers, including the Delmore Brothers, the Stanley Brothers, Earl Bostick, and Ike Turner. Today we're going to hear the story of King Records from John Fox, the author of a new book about the label, Seymour Stein, the founder of Sire Records, who learned the music business at King, and Bootsy Collins, who was a studio musician at King, where he joined James Brown's band. We'll start with an excerpt of our James Brown interview. Brown not only got his start at King, where he became their biggest seller, his first single, Please, 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 was released in 1956 on King's subsidiary label, Federal Records. In our 2005 interview, I asked James Brown about Please, Please, Please. Now, I understand this record almost didn't get released. Your new book says that the owner of King Records, Sid Nathan, didn't want you to release this. What didn't he like about Please, Please, Please?
Well, it was repetition to him because I continued to say, please, please, please. And he heard me say, please, please, 26 times. And didn't ever, you know, had that kind of concept or that kind of music because it was like gospel ballad, you know. And he couldn't understand the pulsating bam, 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 please, please, please. He couldn't understand that. But that was a new horizon coming by him. He totally different from what he did before.
Well, I guess they made a mistake. So
I'm glad they did.
Please, 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 please.
Please, Please, Please on the King record label. King launched James Brown's career, and it's where bass player Bootsy Collins got his start at the age of 15. He was a King studio musician and then joined James Brown's band. He later formed his own group, Bootsy's Rubber Band. I asked Bootsy to share some King memories. Bootsy Collins, welcome back to Fresh Air. So you grew up in Cincinnati, where you still live, and where King Records was based. So before you even started playing at King, did you buy King Records?
Yeah. Well, actually, I probably didn't buy them because at that time we had a couple of friends over at King Records who actually kind of slid us a 45 or two, you know. So anything we kind of wanted, you know, we kind of, you know, asked him, and you know, he knew we didn't have any money. We was a band playing around Cincinnati, you know. Nobody really had any money at that time, so. It kind of, you know, gave us this, that, and the other, whatever we asked for.
Now, before you started playing with James Brown for King Records, you became part of the King house band. So
yeah.
how did you do that? How did you get that job?
Well, actually, we were we were like pissed over at King Records. We were always there. We were always wanting to see who was going into King Records.
Being you and the members of your band, including your brother.
Yes, yes, my brother and Frankie, the drummer, and actually later on became Robert McCullough and a guy named Chicken that played the horn. They came in later, but the rhythm section was the ones that started off, and that was the three of us. And so we started just kind of hanging around over there and just to see the artists coming in. We had no idea we was going to actually get a chance to go in King, you know, because they never let nobody in unless you were an artist and that you were performing and you were doing something, recording. So we were just kind of like fans, I guess you would call. Then we met this guy, Charles Sperling, who was the A&R guy over there at King Records. And he had heard about us, and he wanted to come and see us play. We had talked about ourselves so much, you know. And he wanted to come and see us. So he came to see us at a club, and he thought that we were great. He thought that we would bring a lot of energy to the new rhythm section that he was looking for. And so he invited us over to King Records. And that was the first time we got in King Records.
So what was it like when you got inside?
Oh, man. I mean, you know, from all that fighting to get in, you know, like, wow, we didn't know what to do with ourselves. You know, it was pretty amazing. I mean, it was one thing to see artists going into the studio, but to actually be in the studio and you see them and you hear them recording and putting songs together, it just took it to a whole nother level for us. We were in heaven.
So when you were in the house band and you were playing with different performers, what are some of the things that you learned musically by watching different kinds of performers by having to follow them, you know, backing them
up? I would have to say the main thing, I guess, was we went over there. I got to tell you a little story since you asked that question. We went over there and they didn't really know how much we knew as far as recording, and because, you know, they liked our energy so much and they liked the fact of how we made the records feel. So I think that kind of helped override what we really knew. So at some point they was going to test us. So the big test was, okay, let's put some music in front of these boys and see how they do. So one of the arrangers over there, who actually became James Brown's string and horn arranger, Dave Matthews, he actually put some music in front of us. Because before that, we were just kind of winging it, meaning we were playing what we felt to the song that they were doing. But I think they wanted to see, okay, can these boys really read, or how advanced are they? So they put music in front of us, and we kind of sit there, me and my brother, I never will forget, we looked at each other because we was saying to ourselves, how in the heck are we going to get out of this? Because, you know, neither one of us could read music. I mean, you know, and they sit it in front of us. And then we had Henry Glover there, who was like the top producer, and all of them was looking at us. We had this big orchestra in there, horn, strings, and we were the rhythm section. So it was like, oh, my God. So we were on the spot, and I said, come on, Cat, we can do this. And I said, Dave, can you run it down one time so we can see how it goes? So he ran it down with the whole band, you know, without us. And I said, give it to us one more time so we can get a real good feel for it because we want to do this right. He ran it again. We said, we got it. We played that sucker one time, and they took it, and it was a take, and they loved it. And about 2 or 3 weeks later, after, you know, grueling sessions like that, 2 or 3 weeks later, Dave pulled me to the side. He said, you know, I know you can't read. And I kind of looked at him and started cracking up, and he started laughing, and he said, I understood that you couldn't read in the very first time you you played that first song. He said, I knew you couldn't read. He said, but I liked what you did so well that it didn't even matter. He said, I want to spend some time with you. I want to at least teach you some chord changes and how to read chord changes, you and your brother. And that way we can get through this a lot easier and you won't have to feel so so crushed in these sessions. I said, okay, cool. So he took us to the side and started teaching us how to read chord changes. And that's how we made it through, those sessions.
Well, Bootsy Collins, thank you so much.
Oh, this is awesome.
Bootsy Collins got his start at King Records. We'll talk with the author of a new book about the label after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about King Records, one of the most important independent labels of the 1950s. It launched James Brown's career and recorded a mix of country, blues, and rhythm and blues performers, including the Stanley Brothers, the Delmore Brothers, Lonnie Johnson, Hank Ballard, and Earl Bostick. My guest, John Fox, is the author of a new book about the Cincinnati-based label called King of the Queen City. John Fox, welcome to Fresh Air. You describe King Records as helping to integrate America through music. So what do you mean by that?
Well, King, from the very beginning of the company in the mid-1940s, had a relatively colorblind approach to music. Sid Nathan, the founder of the label, always said that he made music for the little man. And he felt that he was an outsider to mainstream society. So he was very conscious of trying to do the music, trying to satisfy the musical consumers that the major record labels weren't doing. One of the things that he found out doing that was that black and white music, which was kept pretty segregated by record companies and record stores and consumers, was essentially the same thing. If you peel it back one label, country music and blues and rhythm and blues was essentially the same thing. Once he realized that, he began to encourage country artists to record blues and rhythm and blues songs to which he held the copyrights, and vice versa. Blues and rhythm and blues artists record country songs. So that was one way that he helped to break down a barrier. More important way was that King had probably the first integrated staff of any record company in the country, primarily through the hiring of Henry Glover in the mid-1940s. Henry was a black musician, songwriter, record producer, arranger. And in the early years of King, he was essentially the number two man, second only to Sid Nathan. And Henry produced the blues and rhythm and blues that he might have been expected to, but he also produced a lot of country recordings.
Now, you mentioned that what Sid Nathan, the founder of King Records, would do, since he had rhythm and blues artists and country musicians signed to the label, he would take songs that he held the copyright to and have both a rhythm and blues performer and a country group record it. And I want to play an example of that. And this was this is Hank Ballard doing Finger Poppin' Time, which was a pretty big hit for him. And then a Stanley Brothers version of the same song. I'm assuming the Hank Ballard came first.
Yes. Yes, it did. It's a Hank Ballard original.
He wrote it?
Yes.
Okay. So do I have anything to say? Do you have anything to say about this pairing before we hear it?
It's one of my favorite Stanley Brothers songs. It's kind of an odd duck in their catalog. They were among the most traditional bluegrass artists of the time, but they also hadn't had a hit in a long time, and bluegrass was kind of on life support in the late 50s and early 60s when they were making these records for King. Sid Nathan asked them to do this song, and they really had no reason to refuse him, so they did it.
Okay, so here's Hank Ballard, followed by the Stanley Brothers, doing the Hank Ballard song, Finger Poppin' Time.
Hey now, hey now, hey now, hey now, it's finger poppin' time. Finger poppin', poppin' time. I feel so good. Woo! And that's a real good sign. Hey now, hey now, hey now, hey now, hey baby.
trumpet sound. Here comes Mary, here comes Sue, here comes Johnny and a Bobby too. It's finger pop, pop in town. I feel so good, and that's a real good sound.
We just heard the Stanley Brothers version of Finger Poppin' Time, which was originated by Hank Ballard, whose version we first heard. They were both recorded in 1960, both for King Records. And one of the things King Records specialized in was having country and rhythm and blues artists on the same label. My guest, John Hartley Fox, has just written a new book about that record label, which is called King of the Queen City. Well, it's really fun to hear those back to back. Now, another record that you write about in your book about King Records is the song Good Rockin' Tonight, originally recorded by Wynonie Harris in 1948. You make the case that this King record was actually the first rock and roll record. And as you concede, many people would make the case that Ike Turner's Rocket 88 was really the first rock and roll record that came a few years later. Why do you consider Wynonie Harris's Good Rockin' Tonight the first rock and roll record?
That was kind of a goofball claim I made in the book, because it's obviously something that is open to endless debate. But it had the right attitude, and the key was it crossed over to white record buyers. Not as much as later King records in the early 50s did, but this was one of the first, I think, that was heard by white teenagers in fairly large numbers. Evidence of that is Elvis Presley. This was one of Elvis's favorite songs and one of the first ones he recorded.
Is there a story behind how Wynonie Harris ended up recording this for King?
Yeah, the song was written by Roy Brown, who recorded for Deluxe, which was a King subsidiary after a while. And Roy wrote this song and approached Wynonie Harris at one of Wynonie's gigs and tried to sell him the song for, I believe, $50. And Wynonie blew Roy Brown off. So Roy was broke. He needed some money. So he recorded it himself for Deluxe Records. A man named Cecil Gant, a singer who had success on Deluxe, intervened for him with the Braun Brothers, who owned the label, and got Roy a quick contract on Deluxe. He recorded the song and was beginning to have a hit with it. It was certainly a regional hit down around New Orleans and working its way cross country. When Wynonie Harris saw that Roy was beginning to have a hit with the song, he remembered blowing it off and realized his mistake. So he hustled into the King Studios in Cincinnati and cut pretty much an exact copy of Roy Brown's version. But because of King's far superior distribution and marketing, Wynonie got the hit on the record. So he made an initial mistake, but he corrected it.
We'll talk more about King Records and hear more music in the second half of the show. John Fox is the author of King of the Queen City, The Story of King Records. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with John Fox, the author of the new book, King of the Queen City, The Story of King Records. The Cincinnati-based label was founded in 1943 by Sid Nathan, who ran it until 1971. King recorded country, blues, and rhythm and blues, launched the career of James Brown, and released the original versions of Fever, The Twist, and Good Rockin' Tonight. Now, King Records also had a reputation for recording some songs with sexual overtones or double entendres. One of the big examples would be the Domino's recording of 60 Minute Man. So were there problems with either radio stations not wanting to play it or parental negative reaction? Like, what was the response to these sexual innuendo kind of songs?
Well, those songs were pretty universally banned from radio airplay and were condemned from every pulpit, public and secular. But kids loved it. Sid Nathan was not the first to find that controversy doesn't hurt record sales in the slightest. And this was one of the first big crossovers, and I think that that white kids bought by the thousands. And I think that that was the real reason for the controversy, was that it came really to the first time of the attention of a lot of moral arbiters of the country.
So from the early 1950s, here's the Domino's recording of 60 Minute Man.
Take my hand. When I let you go, you'll cry. Oh yes, he's a 60-minute man. There'll be 15 minutes of kissing. Then you holler, please don't stop.
Don't stop.
There'll be 50 minutes teasing and 50 minutes squeezing and 50 minutes of blowing my top.
That's the Domino's recording of 60 Minute Man on the King record label. And the King label is the subject of the new book, King of the Queen City being Cincinnati. My guest is the author of the book, John Hartley Fox. Of all the performers signed by King, probably the most successful, the most famous, the most groundbreaking was James Brown. How did King Records end up signing James Brown?
Ralph Bass was a producer and talent scout for King Records. He ran Federal Records, which was one of their subsidiaries. And he, for most of each year, traveled the country looking for talent. He ran across a demo tape of James Brown at an Atlanta radio station, found that they were in Macon, went there, finally made connection with a mover and shaker named Clint Brantley, and then went to hear James, and Ralph was blown away by them, Ralph Bass was. He offered them an immediate contract to come up to Cincinnati and record. There was a song on the demo that Ralph was particularly impressed by called Please, Please, Please. And that was the main song he wanted. So he went after him, heard him at a club in Macon, Georgia, and signed him on the spot, beating Chess Records to the punch.
And Please, Please, Please was the first record that James Brown released on the King label.
Yes.
And it was a big hit.
It was a big regional hit. It wasn't really a national hit, but it was a big enough hit that it got some national notice.
Now, the way you tell the story in the book, Sid Nathan, the owner of the label, the founder of the label, didn't like this record and didn't like the idea of releasing it.
He hated the record. He had several caustic comments about it and actually interrupted the recording studio, yelling at Ralph Bass that nobody wanted to hear this kind of music. And he threw a big tantrum, and Ralph Bass finally just challenged him and said, look, I know what this is. I know that I've got a hit here. You just put the record out in Atlanta, Georgia, and if it's not a hit there, I'll quit. I'll just quit. You don't have to fire me. I quit. Ralph was that sure of it. And that mollified Sid enough that he went back into the control room, and after everybody got their composure regained, they went ahead and recorded that song.
So did Sid Nathan, who didn't like this record very much and founded the record company, end up making peace with James Brown when he realized how popular and how lucrative it was to be affiliated with James Brown?
Theirs was an uneasy piece. They basically went through the same song and dance every record. James wanting to do what... James road tested his material before he recorded it. So he had a pretty good idea what was working at the band's appearances, what really shook up the audience and what they didn't care for. Sid, on the other hand, usually viewed all of James' ideas as terrible, and all of the music is just unreleasable. And they fought that battle, and James outsmarted him various ways, worked around him various ways. And the records were always successful. like the Live at the Apollo. James had to pay to record that himself. But then once Sid Nathan realized how good it was and what he had, he bought it from James.
Now, Sid Nathan eventually owned a piece of every aspect of the record business. Correct me if I'm wrong here. He had studios, he had a pressing plant, a distribution company, a trucking business. Am I missing anything?
Yeah, he actually made turntables for a while. They sold King. Well, he didn't make them, but they sold King turntables, King record players.
So
you could actually get the whole thing under one roof.
I think we've probably done a better job in showcasing a little bit of the rhythm and blues that King recorded than the country. Would you choose one of your favorite country recordings that came out of King?
Blues Stay Away From Me by the Delmore Brothers.
And why are you choosing that?
Well, I think it's a great song, first of all. That's what Sid Nathan would want me to say. It's a great song that has stood the test of time. But it also, in one song recorded in one day at the recording studio in Cincinnati, it kind of demonstrates the King model at work. It was an in-studio collaboration between the two Delmore brothers, Alton and Rabin, who were from North Alabama, Wayne Rainey, a harmonica player from Arkansas. Those three were white from the South. And then Henry Glover, the producer of the song, the producer of the recording session and the co-writer of the song. The four of them in the studio worked up the song from ideas that Alton Delmore and Henry Glover brought to the table. And the entire process was an equal collaboration between those four men. And I think that that just kind of illustrates the way that King let their artist do what they wanted to do, but also helped introduce them to different things, like Sid Nathan wanting the Stanley Brothers to record Finger Pop in Time, or wanting some of his other country artists to record these black songs that he, or these R&B and blues songs that he had the control of that he thought were good songs. This was just sort of, in one song, was the distillation of the King model at work.
Well, John Fox, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me, Terry.
John Hartley Fox is the author of the new book, King of the Queen City, The Story of King Records.
Blues, stay away from me. Blues, why don't you let me be? Don't know why you keep on haunting.
My guest, Seymour Stein, founded Sire Records and signed Madonna, the Ramones, and Talking Heads, launching their careers. Stein learned the record business at King Records, where founder Sid Nathan became his mentor. At Nathan's funeral, Stein was one of the pallbearers. When Nathan was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Seymour Stein was the presenter. Stein was only 14 when he met Sid Nathan. At the time, the young Stein was working at Billboard magazine. Billboard used to host listening sessions where record company owners would play their recordings and try to persuade Billboard to give them a good review. Stein met Sid Nathan at one of those sessions.
I remember that session, you know, like it was yesterday. And it was over 50 years ago. Sid was there and another record man was there as well. What I remember very clearly was there were a large amount of records to listen to, and the last two or three were on the Jubilee label, and one of the reporters said, I hear Jubilee Records is going out of business. Why should we even bother with these records? He said, I'm sure, you know, Sid is getting a little bored here. And Sid said, in the way he spoke, you know, he said, look, what if I wasn't here? Would you talk that way about me? Listen to these records. And so the person said, boy, Jerry Blaine, who is the owner of Jubilee Records, he said, he must be a good friend of yours. And he said, oh, no, I'm suing the son of a bitch. And he said, but what's right is right, you know. And one of the records actually became a hit. I can't remember. It might have been White Silver Sands by Don Rondo or someone like that. So
how did you get to work for Sid Nathan?
He invited me out to spend the summer with him. I was still in high school. I was 15. And I said, yeah, wow. And my parents were a bit, you know, my father was an Orthodox Jew and, you know, it just didn't understand all of this. And I'd brought them up to Billboard. And an appointment was made, which I didn't talk to my parents for a couple of weeks. I was so embarrassed that they would, you know, question something that was so wonderful. And just as he walked into Sid's office, he put out my father's cheap cigar, and Sidney immediately reached into his pocket and gave him a Havana, which my father was not used to. And he had my father in his pocket. And he said, well, he said, Seymour here, he's got shellac in his veins. And what a compliment. It meant that, you know, I was a record man, you know, because shellac was the main ingredient in old 78s. And then he explained that to my father. He said, if you don't let him do what he wants to do, he's going to wind up doing nothing, and you'll have to buy him a newspaper route because that's all he'll be good for. And this was April, and my parents rushed home, and when I got home, everything was packed. I wasn't supposed to leave till the end of June when high school was up.
So how old were you when you went to work with Sid Nathan at King Records full-time?
Full-time. Was 1961, 62, so I would have been 19 or just turning 20.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that Sid Nathan did for you after you started working with him at King Records was tell you to change your name. Your real last name was?
Oh, I was born with the name Steinbeagle, Seymour Steinbeagle.
And what was wrong with that in Sid Nathan's eyes?
It was too long. And he kept asking me to change it, and I didn't want to hurt my father's feelings. My father was the eldest son, and both his brothers had changed their name, had shortened it. But he felt, out of respect to his father, he should keep it.
But you did change it.
Yes. Not everybody had phones at King Records. People shared phones, as much as three or four people could share a phone at one time. But there was a paging system, and the switchboard operator had one microphone, and Sid had the other one on his desk. And I was being paged. I had an incoming call. Seymour Steinbeagle, pick up the closest phone, Seymour Steinbeagle, there's a call. And she was repeating it over and over again. And all of a sudden, Sid's voice came on. And he said, oh, no, it's Stein or Biggle or back to New York. And I almost started to cry. I was so embarrassed. And I changed my name. And I'm very glad that I did.
So you got started at Billboard magazine. Do you ever miss the importance of the charts, the days when, like, top 40 really meant something?
I miss it a lot.
What do you miss about it?
I miss all the excitement. I mean, that's how I heard about Billboard. There was this disc jockey long before rock and roll, Martin Block.
WNEW in New York.
Yes.
Make-believe ballroom.
Exactly. It's make-believe ballroom time and free to everyone. Well, I would come back on Saturday mornings from the synagogue and have my radio sort of under the pillow so my father couldn't hear it when he came home, listening to Martin Block play the top 25 off of the Billboard chart. And later he started playing, in addition, the top 5 R&B and the top 5 country and western. And that's how I got introduced to Johnny Cash and Ray Price and Hank Williams on the one hand, and to some of the R&B records, to my idol, Fats Domino, as well. Radio was very important in the charts, and they played the Billboard charts. That was what Martin Block played off of, and that's how I knew to go up to Billboard.
So you miss it. You miss those days of the charts.
Oh, I sure do.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Seymour Stein, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Seymour Stein founded Sire Records and got his start at King Records with King's founder, Sid Nathan. The new book about King Records, King of the Queen City, was written by John Harley Fox. We want to thank Brian Powers for all his help with our show about King. He's the music librarian at the Public Library of Cincinnati and has done extensive research on King. Beginning Sunday, IFC, the independent film channel, presents a 6-evening, 6-hour documentary about Monty Python's Flying Circus, timed to commemorate the 40th anniversary of the groundbreaking British TV series and comedy troupe. It's called Monty Python, Almost the Truth, The Lawyer's Cut. And our TV critic, David Bianculli, has this review.
It's good to know, after all these years, that the surviving members of Monty Python still can't even take themselves seriously. Oh, they have the best of intentions with this new mega documentary called Monty Python, Almost the Truth, The Lawyer's Cut. They really do want to explain where their peculiar sense of humor came from, and how the six of them met, and the inspirations for their most famous sketches, record albums, movies, and stage shows. But just as the original Monty Python's Flying Circus poked fun at the stiffness of the BBC when it premiered on the BBC back in 1969, this new documentary can't help but send up the documentary form a little. Its individual hours sport such titles as The Not-So-Interesting Beginnings and The Much Funnier Second Episode. And for the theme song of this new production, the Pythons not only resurrect the main title music from the life of Brian, but a dead ringer for the original vocalist as well.
Python, the brand new documentary of Python. It's a new documentary. It's about Monty Python. Unlike other Monty Python documentaries, this is brand new. It's a new documentary. It's not complimentary, but it's better than a hysterectomy. It's Monty Python!
There's an added joke in that each hour has its own theme song, which is sung with increased frustration over how endless the documentary is and how familiar the material. Obviously, the Pythons are sensitive enough to this charge to make a preemptive strike. After all, there was a 30th anniversary Monty Python TV special a decade ago, and a 20th anniversary one a decade before that. And home video collectors have had more than one opportunity to buy a Monty Python's Flying Circus mega set on DVD. But for such familiar terrain and such an old comedy group, there's a lot of new insight here. Enough to please hardcore Python fans, and intriguing enough to turn new viewers into probable converts. My favorite installment is the first one, which is generous with its clip from the early radio and TV shows that influenced or featured the future members of Monty Python. Peter Sellers and his infamously unstructured The Goon Show was one clear inspiration. The satiric stage review Beyond the Fringe, with Peter Cook, Dudley Moore, and Jonathan Miller, was another. And the British version of the topical variety series That Was the Week That Was, which, like The Office, was Americanized with a new cast, was a third. Some of the Pythons came from Cambridge, some from Oxford, and American Terry Gilliam came seemingly out of nowhere. But eventually, the six of them, Gilliam, John Cleese, Terry Jones, Michael Palin, Eric Idle, and Graham Chapman, found their own styles and voices. They presented a TV show where sketches were absurd and unpredictable, and where comedy targets ranged from little old ladies and dead philosophers to the Spanish Inquisition. Insanely imaginative animation linked one sketch to another. Or, as an alternative, John Cleese would simply stare into the camera and intone with the deep seriousness of a BBC announcer, and now for something completely different. And all of it was completely different, then and now, from the Ministry of Silly Walks and the fish-slapping dance to the dead parrot sketch. Here's John Cleese returning a recent purchase to pet store owner Michael Palin.
I wish to make it complete. Sorry, we're closing for lunch.
Never mind that, my lad. I wish to complain about this parrot what I purchased not half an hour ago from this very boutique.
Oh, yes, the Norwegian blue. What's wrong with it?
I'll tell you what's wrong with it. It's dead. That's what's wrong with it.
Except for Graham Chapman, who died 20 years ago, all the other pythons are alive and well and contribute fresh interviews to this documentary. There also are such well-chosen ingredients as clips from a British TV talk show back when Monty Python's The Life of Brian was released. John Cleese and Michael Palin appeared on the talk show to debate an angry bishop, and in these exchanges, Malcolm Muggeridge, a former satirist and author who had just converted to Christianity. He found the Python's biblical humor positively sacrilegious. In this clip, Cleese and Palin take on Muggeridge. Then Cleese, in a new interview for the documentary, recalls Palin's atypically biting reaction, which we then hear.
You keep making the basic assumption that we are ridiculing Christ and Christ's teaching, and I say that we are not.
But do you imagine that your scene, for instance, of the Sermon on the Mount, the scene in this, in your film of the Sermon on the Mount,
right,
is not ridiculing one of the most sublime utterances that any human being has ever spoken on this earth? Of course it is.
No, it's
absolutely
making fun
not.
Of the guy who's remembered it wrong and of the people who don't understand it and miss the point.
Well,
I think that's really unfair, because I think that a lot of people looking in will think that we have actually ridiculed Christ.
Yes.
Physically. Christ is played by an actor, Ken Colley. He speaks the words from the Sermon on the Mount. He's treated absolutely respectfully. The camera then pans away. We go right to the back of the crowd to someone who shouts, "Speak up," because they cannot hear him. Now, I mean, if that utterly,
that utterly
undermines one's faith in Christ, then I think your faith cannot be
turned
that strong.
That was kind of fun. What was particularly fun, it was the crossest I've ever seen Michael Palin. Not a man is easily upset. It's almost apoplectic.
I started off by saying that this is such a tenth-rate film that I don't believe that it would disturb anybody's
faith. Yes, I know you started with an open
faith.
Mind. I realise that.
If I have a complaint about this six-hour documentary, it's that it could have been longer. Eric Idle's recent musical stage triumph, in which he turned the movie Monty Python and the Holy Grail into the Broadway hit Spamalot, is covered. But we don't hear from David Hyde Pierce, Hank Azaria, or other members of that show, including Sarah Ramirez, now on Grey's Anatomy. And if Spamalot gets its due, why not other Python solo ventures, like Eric Idle's The Ruddles All You Need Is Cash, Michael Palin's Ripping Yarns, John Cleese's Faulty Towers, or Terry Gilliam's Brazil, all of them brilliant. Yes, there's room for even more. And the DVD version of The Lawyer's Cut includes an additional disc, which does feature, among other things, the origin of Faulty Towers. But even if you just watch the televised version on IFC, you'll be quite entertained. And stay till the very end, because the credits on the last episode close with one final, very solid laugh. It's too good to spoil. But just like Monty Python, it's something completely different.
David Bianculli writes for TVWorthWatching.com and teaches television and film at Rowan University. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.
A documentary of the TV.